From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Matt Groening. The creator of The Simpsons has a new animated series premiering on Fox at the end of the month. It's called Futurama and is set in the year 3000 in New York City. Also, the controversial CBS variety series that was to the 60s what Saturday Night Live was to the 70s, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. There's an anniversary coming up. 30 years ago, they were fired and their show was thrown off the air. I'll talk with Tom Smothers. And film critic John Powers reviews True Crime, the new Clint Eastwood movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Villard Books, publishers of Running to the Mountain, A Journey of Faith and Change by John Katz.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, usually the TV critic, but today I'm sitting in for Terry Gross. A year ago, when I talked with Simpsons creator Matt Groening, one of the topics we discussed was the possibility of him doing another TV series. One thing I'm wondering about, since they do realize the value of the show at Fox, there has been no official Simpsons spinoff. And I know for a long time you wanted one and weren't sure in what direction you would take it. In terms of either television or film, where does that stand now? Or is there an entire new series that is coming from you fairly soon?
Well, part of the problem with The Simpsons is that there is so much money that going around and around in this project that anything that involves signing new contracts makes the actual negotiations difficult or impossible. I did try to do a Simpsons spinoff, Krusty the Clown. It was originally conceived as a live-action spinoff starring Dan Castellaneta, who does the voice of Krusty as well as Homer.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that would be an amusing conceit. That is, the idea that you would do a live-action spinoff of a cartoon. But I actually sat in a big room with a bunch of people, and we talked about this, and everybody took very, very greedy positions. And I said, hey, look, if you guys all take the second greediest position, we can do this thing. We can do it. It'll be fun. And you'll still make lots and lots of money, but let's do it. But they wouldn't take the second greediest position. Everybody wanted all the money, and you can't do it that way. So that's why there has never been a Simpsons spinoff, or why there's never been a Simpsons movie. I'd love to do it. I'd love to do a movie, but it ain't going to happen. There's too much money grubbing involved. That's why I had to go on and do my own TV show, my new one. I'm working on a new animated series where we're all going to work for free. And it's going to be fun. No, we're not. No, it's going to, we're starting over, starting fresh. And, it's going to be fun.
But you're starting fresh and you're going to write the contract so that you retain rights this time?
You can't do it. It's Hollywood. It's crazy here. But what I do is try to have more fun. I mean, that's the reason. This new show, which is very similar in sensibility to The Simpsons, it'll be fast-paced. The characters have big eyeballs, and they'll have no chins, and their skin's not going to be yellow. It's not a spinoff. It's a brand-new show. Don't sue me. So, anyway, it's... where was I?
What the show is going to be, new show.
Oh, yeah, so it's going to be... it's going to take place in the future. It's kind of a science fiction thing. What we have done to the American family... with The Simpsons, we're going to try to do to science fiction and the future with this new show. It's called Futurama.
Now it's a year later, and Futurama is a reality. The new cartoon series premieres on Fox a week from Sunday. It's about a pizza delivery boy who gets frozen by accident on New Year's Eve 2000. He wakes up 1,000 years in the future, only to be thrown into a room with a woman with one eye, played by Katie Sagal.
Name?
Fry?
I'm Leela. Now, it's New Year's Eve, so I'd like to decide your fate quickly and get out of here.
Can I ask you a question?
As long as it's not about my eye. Is it about my eye?
Sort of.
Just ask the question.
What's with the eye?
I'm an alien, all right? Let's drop the subject.
Cool, an alien. Has your race taken over the Earth?
No, I just work here.
Wait a minute. Is that blimp accurate?
Yep. It's December 31st, 2999.
My God! 1,000,000 years!
I'm sure this must be very upsetting for you.
You know, I guess it should be, but actually, I'm glad. I had nothing to live for in my old life. I was broke, I had a humiliating job, and I was beginning to suspect my girlfriend might be cheating on me.
Well, at least here you'll be treated with dignity. Now strip naked and get on the probulator.
Futurama is a wonderful show, and for fans of The Simpsons, it's wonderful news that Matt Groening, after 10 years, has another show on television. I spoke with him in 1998 and asked how he got involved with television and with Simpsons producer James L. Brooks in the first place.
Well, Jim was working with a producer named Polly Platt, who liked my cartoon strip Life in Hell, which was running in the Los Angeles Reader at the time, a local weekly paper. And She showed him my stuff. He liked it, and they tried to get me to put my cartoons as background props in a movie that he was doing, and that didn't work out. And then the Tracy Ullman show came along, and they asked me if I wanted to try my hand at animation, and that was the beginning of it.
Where did you think it was going to lead? How long did you think that would last?
Well, they called me up, and they said we're doing this new comedy variety show, and they wanted to have little animated cartoons as part of the show, and suggested that I animate my life in hell characters, which I thought was a great idea. I found out that I would give up ownership of whatever it is that I put up, and so I created The Simpsons in their stead, because, you know, life in hell with my rabbits and Akbar and Jeff, that's a regular gig, and I was doing just fine with that, and I didn't know if this animation thing was going to pan out at all. And I decided not to sacrifice my own characters. So I made up these other characters I didn't really care about. The Simpsons. And they were, you know, in the back of my mind, I really wanted to, you know, do this thing as a TV series. I thought it should be a TV series. And so it was inspired by both memories of my own family and in the family sitcoms that I was glued to when I was a kid. Leave It to Beaver. And Ozzie and Harriet in particular were really important to me as a kid. You know, Ozzie and Harriet, everybody thinks, oh, Ozzie and Harriet. It's like this sort of symbol for blandness. And it was kind of corny and bland, but it was also really surreal. And I'm telling you, watch those reruns. They used to run them on the Disney Channel. I don't know where they are now, but they're fantastic, really. The good ones, the early ones. Not when Ricky and Dave got married, it wasn't as good. But when they were kids, when they were still going through adolescence, it was really a cool show.
One major element of The Simpsons that you're cashing in on lately with CD releases is
cashing in Simpsons. Well, how can you even put those two words in the same sentence?
I don't know. But
okay,
that was not a disparaging cashing in, because I listen to the CDs all the time.
Cashing in Hollywood. That's the biggest superlative there is.
Well, how involved are you in the music with Danny Elfman, with everybody who does the music? I don't know how some of the episodes that are very heavy on music even get thought up in the first place. How do you know that everybody can do it when you're going to do a musical version of A Streetcar Named Desire, for example?
Well, I mean, we have talented actors who will you know, throw themselves into this stuff. Alf Clausen, who does the music for the show, he was fantastic. He's able to come up with amazing solutions to the problems that are thrown at him. We're doing a second CD of stuff from the show, and you know, I'm just amazed that we didn't run out of material from the first CD, but we've got, the show is jam-packed with music. You know, The Simpsons is one of the few shows that's actually fully orchestrated these days. I thought back at the very beginning of the show that we needed an orchestra because the animation was going to be so crude and wobbly that anything we could do to anchor the animation in some kind of solidity that you could at least hear would be a real help. And now I like it just because I think, you know, I'm tired of synthesizers, which is what you hear on most other shows. I like that orchestral sound.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Matt Groening at home when you're not at The Simpsons. How do you and your kids react to TV now? What life do you have when you're not working?
Well, I have two sons, aged 9 and 6, and they're huge fans of the show, and we have tapes of The Simpsons. And when I get up in the morning and come down to breakfast, they're usually watching the show. And I, you know, I'm not in the best of mood before I've had my coffee, and so I tell them to shut it off. And they now think that I hate The Simpsons because I don't want to hear it before I, you know, wake up in the morning. I don't like to be woken up to the sound of Bart. Also, another thing is, you know, and I'll take this opportunity to apologize to America. You know, there was a lot of complaints about Bart and what a brat he was and a bad example for kids. And I thought, oh, come on, grow up. Stop acting like Homer Simpson and your kids won't act like Bart Simpson. But the fact is, now that I have these kids, and they're quoting the show back to me, it is really annoying. I mean, we did on The Simpsons, we did, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? In the car. My kids, still, years later, they still think that's funny.
What were some of the things that warped you early as a teenager? I know that Bullwinkle had to be, Rocky and Bullwinkle had to be a big influence.
I loved Rocky and Bullwinkle. I've said this before. Jay Ward and Bill Scott, who did that, were my heroes. Because here was bad animation. I mean, let's face it, Rocky and Bullwinkle is pretty flimsy looking. But it had great writing, and it had great voices, and it had great music. And I thought, boy, if you could get something like that on the air again, it'd be really fun to do. And that was one of my goals in life, and, you know.
It's one of the animated rules that I remember you mentioning is that the Simpsons will never cross their eyes. And I don't know if that goes for the other characters in the show as well, but it's just one thing that you just didn't want to have your characters do.
Oh, yeah, stylistically, there's a few rules on the Simpsons. That's one of them, that they don't go cross-eyed for gag effect. Like if you clonk them on the head, they don't go cross-eyed, and stars don't go above their heads, and little birds fly around or anything like that. Generally, when the Simpsons fall off the cliff, the unrealistic thing is that they survive, but the realistic thing is that they're, you know, battered and bloody. You know, so I think we're one of the first cartoons to actually show blood. You know, I think even in the Tom and Jerry cartoons and some of the other very violent cat and mouse cartoons, there was no blood, but there's blood on The Simpsons.
And certainly on Itchy and
Scratchy. Know I'm proud of that, yes. Too, because I don't know why.
Well, what are some of the other rules that you decided on at the very beginning when you were first
Well,
doing
as far as eyeballs go, basically the characters look straight ahead or they go slightly wall-eyed to convey alienation. They don't have that one eye up and one pupil up, one pupil down look, you know, for craziness too. What's some of the other rules? Just as far as sound effects, no boings, no boing, you know, when they get hit. All the sound effects are relatively realistic. I mean, you know, when Homer falls over and you know, cracks his back against a fire hydrant, it's a celery crunch, but it could be a spine.
Now,
it's that it's not a boing, you know, it's not a Three Stooges sound effect.
But with sound effects, is it true that you originally provided the sound effect that you did the sucking for Maggie on the pacifier?
Well, on the pacifier, yeah. Well, yes, I did.
And have you now turned that duty over to a pacifier
specialist?
No,
I think through the miracle of modern technology, as far as I know, it's still the same suck. It's they only had to do it once, and then they just keep repeating it. You know, that's how it goes.
Wow.
That's just my tongue against my lower lip.
What do you have about keeping Bart, especially at that exact age in school?
You know, one of the great things about animation is that your actors don't get old and decrepit. You know, they don't rob stores. They don't, you know, they don't have tragic rehab stories. You know, anything like that. They just stay the way you draw them. And I think it's one of the fun things we have with The Simpsons is that Bart has turned 10 so many times. And, you know, we've talked about aging them. When this actor's strike happened on the show, there was one suggestion from a Fox executive to, why don't you just age the characters and then have different voices? That's a solution. We thought that was not such a good
idea. That's
scary.
My guest is Simpsons creator Matt Groening. His new show, Futurama, premieres on Fox a week from this Sunday. We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Matt Groening. I spoke with him last April when the 200th episode of The Simpsons aired. I asked him how The Simpsons are like other American families.
I think one of the things about The Simpsons is it really is about the anxiety and consternation of living with people who drive you out of your mind. Because it's animation and because it's a comedy, we do a lot of foreshortening, a lot of slight exaggeration. I call it rubber band reality. That is, it's real, and then we stretch it out for a moment, and then it snaps back to reality. But it is about the things that drive you crazy. I mean, how do you live with people you love and you want to kill? I think that's the underlying theme of The Simpsons. And in the midst of all that, it's a celebration of that idea. That is, at the end of the day, it's not a Beckett play. It's a cartoon.
How do you think The Simpsons stacks up against more three-dimensional sitcoms? And in particular, the characters of the mothers, the fathers, and the kids?
Well, you know, I don't want to compare what we do to other TV shows in live action, because I think when I look at those shows, I go, God, how do they do that? How can you write scenes that take place in the same room, you know, week after week after week? You know, where characters just have to come in and out of doors in order to, you know, to move things around. I mean, in The Simpsons, we can go anywhere we want to. We can go into the characters' fantasy worlds. We can show the TV shows that they enjoy. We can go into outer space and underwater and all kinds of stuff. We have 40 or 50 characters in a single episode. And I think that it certainly spoiled me. When I tried to do that Krusty the Clown spinoff that I was talking about earlier, part of the problem of doing a live-action version of it is when I had written a scene in which this beaver was gnawing away at the foundation of Krusty's house. The fox said, "Did you realize how much it's going to cost to get a beaver? We can't get a trained beaver to gnaw on the wood. You know, a stuffed beaver was even going to cost a lot. And forget about a robotic beaver."
Besides,
so,
you know,
so if it's a cartoon, you can draw that beaver.
And Matt, to resort to the old beaver eating the house in the pilot.
Well, you know, it was the premise was that Krusty moved to Hollywood and became a big self-hating talk show host,
mm-hmm.
and he lived in a house on stilts. And he throughout the entire series, he was going to hear this gnawing sound and not quite figure out what it was. But we, the audience, would know that it was a beaver.
Well, tell me, in terms of, since you watched so much TV as a kid, and I did as well.
You say that like an accusation.
No, I'm yeah, actually...
Well, okay, here's the deal. You watch TV the way I did, and I really felt guilty about all the TV that I watched. I thought, geez, oh my God, it's the one life I have to live, and I'm just think of the commercials I've wasted, you know, watching all this life. Oh, God. And I thought, the only way I can make this pay off is I actually do a TV show. Then it's all research. Then I've justified it. So this is my pathetic attempt to make up for all that wasted time.
And so the reason for making a second one, now that you've justified the lifetime with the
first? Oh, the second one is really, and this is true, it's an attempt to do the first one right. It's an attempt to have fun this time. Not that The Simpsons hasn't been fun, but it's been a mix. And I've learned a lot over the course of these last 11 years since I've been working with these characters. And this time, I know what to expect. I know how to do it, and I'm going to have a lot more fun.
Do you have any sense watching your kids right now that they're getting the same seditious enjoyment out of mass media or even alternative media that you did when you were a kid?
Well, I tried to. This is going to sound worse than it is, but I tried to use my kids as a little experiment. What I tried to do is see what happens if you don't hold back on what the kids are able to look at. I mean, I don't let them watch really scary horror movies or things like that, but they get to watch videos, they get to play video games, they have their computer and their CD-ROMs and their musical instruments and comic books and magazines and monster books and all the rest of that stuff. And I just pretty much don't put a limit on the kinds of stuff they can look at or view or play with. And as a result, or not as a result, but in my particular experiment, I got kids who read like crazy and and play video games like crazy, too, and watch tapes of The Simpsons. So far, it's worked out really well because they're interested in everything. And, you know, I had to sneak around a little bit. And maybe the reason why it was so fun for me was because a lot of the stuff was a little bit taboo. And with them, they take it for granted.
Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons. I spoke with him last year. His new show, Futurama, will premiere on Fox a week from Sunday. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Stella! Stella! Can't you hear me, Ella? You're putting me through hell. Stella! Stella!
I have always depended on the kindness of strangers.
You can always depend on the kindness of strangers to walk up your spirit and shield you from dangers.
Now here's a tip from Bert you won't regret.
All strangers just don't break you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support comes from the National Endowment for the Arts and Bantam Books, publishers of Just Like a Woman, How Gender Science is Redefining What It Means to Be Female, available in hardcover nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, creating groundbreaking TV comedy, a talk with Tom Smothers of the Smothers Brothers about television, censorship, and why he linked up with his little brother Dick in the first place. And John Powers reviews True Crime, the new Clint Eastwood movie.
We'd like all of you tonight to join in with us and sing along with our new album, Sing Along with Smothers.
What's it similar to?
Similar to the album on Columbia Records. This is Mercury Records, but similar to the record on Columbia made by Mitch Miller. Sing Along with Bitch.
Mitch.
Oh, we are marching to Pretoria, Pretoria, Pretoria. Oh, we are marching to Pretoria, Pretoria today. Hey, we are marching to Pretoria, Pretoria, Pretoria. Oh, we are marching to Pretoria, Pretoria today.
Brother Dickie Smothers.
Well, sing with me and I'll sing with you, and we will sing together, and we will dance together, and we will sing together. Well, sing with me and I'll sing with you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Next month, it will be 30 years since CBS fired Tom and Dick Smothers and yanked their hit variety series off the air. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour was pulled not for low ratings, but because the network considered so much of their material too controversial. Here's a typical taste from the final season, with Tom Smothers playing a character about to marry a woman played by black singer Nancy Wilson.
But Celeste, aren't we forgetting about one thing that people are sure to talk about, and something that they will try to destroy our relationship, and which will cause immeasurable damage to our children?
Thomas, what are you talking about?
The fact that I'm white and you're black.
I'm what?
Tom, who plays guitar, and Dick, who plays bass, are still out on tour, and they've done plenty of other television over the years. Their classic Comedy Hour shows were rerun for the first and only time by the E! Cable Network in the early 90s. I talked with Tom in 1997 and asked him how he felt those old Comedy Hours held up after so many years. He was a bit ambivalent.
I felt that the success of the Smother Show and its impact was based on the venue, the actual time and place and the emotions, and there was the middle of the Vietnam War, and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated, and there was right-wing, left-wing, hawks and doves, and it seemed to me, and it bore out for me anyway. When I saw him, I kind of cringed. I still wanted to edit him a little bit and make him a little bit better, and I thought that playing daily out of sequence lost the impact, and I was afraid that maybe people who remembered the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour so fondly would have been disappointed to see them out of context and say, well, that wasn't like I remembered it, like going back to your high school or your junior high school and say, the school isn't as big as I remember, the old house.
But people got to go back to it when they were rebroadcast on E! In the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And even at those things, you and your brother, Dick, did these wraparound tapings, putting everything into context. And you even there looked to be, on most shows, having less of a good time than your brother did. I mean, was I reading too much into that, or were you...
That was very astute. Yes, I was having a miserable time. I started off looking at each tape, but there was 72 of them. Finally, I just went brain dead on it. And there was things I wanted to tighten up for the showing because I had to take some time out to put the wraparounds. And over those 20 years before they were shown again, I'd watched them, but I always felt it was a little too much applause. And then I would I think that maybe we could have spoken better, could have expressed some of the ideas better. But I seem to be an exception to that. A lot of people like them.
Well, yeah, I was going to try and find a nice, polite way to say that I think you're nuts.
That's what my brother said.
Yeah, because, I mean, when it comes to the 60s, you really can't find anything on television that boiled it all down into one lump than the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. I mean, the sexual revolution, the drugs, the rock and roll, the peace movement, the generation gap, anti-authority, mm-hmm. it's all right there. And yet you did it without losing the core audience that you started with.
No, that was an exceptional thing. Mason Williams was a great contributor, and the process was really fun. We never quite had a chance to, I always thought to do the craft better. And that's probably what I'm thinking about. Someone told me Bob Newhart was looking at, did an interview with him, and they're playing some of his old albums back. And in fact, his first album, The Button Down Mind, he says, God, I can't stand that. Don't play it. And he says, why? It's great. So, well, they took some of the pauses out to tighten it up, and that's not my timing. So I don't think anybody who's ever been a writer or a performer or a musician has recorded or published something hasn't looked back at their earlier work with a more critical eye.
When you got the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, mm-hmm. didn't you get the opportunity of creative control because you were basically going into a no-lose time slot like someone would today going in opposite Seinfeld?
Pretty much. We did a half-hour situation comedy just before that, the season before, 32 shows. And I was very unhappy with the writing, and they wrote for Tommy Smothers. I did most of the lines. Dickie was basically ignored, and I was working too hard. So when we got this new show, they said, we'll give you a variety show. I said, well, I want creative control. I said, you got it. I said, that means the content and writer approval and all those... cast and people, and they said, yeah. Because there was no chance the show was going to make it anyways against Bonanza, so all the shows had been failing. So they were very cavalier and very flip about it. Also, there's no reason not to grant us creative control because we had shown no inclination. We were short hairs. We were clean cut. They didn't expect anything that happened. I don't think anybody at that time in the mid-60s expected the expression of dismay over the war and voter registration, all these things that were just taking place, and sexual revolution, all those things. So,
Were you just laying in the weeds? I mean, did you have this grand plan?
I had no plan. I think most people don't have plans that sometimes do something extraordinary. I got censored, so I started saying things that, not even knowing that there was anything wrong with them. But then I started becoming a little more involved, and then pretty soon it became a, someone says, you can't say that. I would say, oh, we can too.
Yeah, well, you were basically the only young guy with a platform at that time on primetime television.
We were, I in hindsight, I can see what we were, the Smothers Brothers were pretty much, had no choice. We were young. The whole staff was basically young with some seasoned writers in there, but primarily was under 30. Rob Reiner, Steve Martin, Mason Williams, Bob Einstein, they all felt the same way as youth did. It was a great cultural clash, and we were there with a show, and we had to reflect that. It was just, I think it was a responsibility, even though I didn't think it then. But I perceive it now as that we had no choice.
But I still don't think you're giving yourself enough credit. To say that you had no choice and were sort of dragged along, or you were at the, you know, the fringes of this movement that we're carrying around anyway, is one thing. But you were, in terms of the rock and roll acts that you presented, the things that you brought on, the stuff that you discussed, going against the war, you basically were the center. And there's actually a clip that I'd like to play for you.
Okay.
That goes back from the old show, and this is basically November of 68, I think. Mm. And this is 2 weeks after you had the Beatles on to premiere Hey Jude and Revolution, which is not a shabby musical booking. And then you're lining up the acts for that week's show, and then this happens.
Tommy also has a special guest, too, and he'd like to introduce him right now, wouldn't he?
That's right. I have a Beatle.
Yeah, but it's not the kind of Beatle you would expect it to be. It's the kind of Beatle that you, I think you hoped it would be. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Harrison. Do you have something important?
Something very important to say on American television.
You know, we don't have opportunity of saying anything important because it's American television. Every time you say something, they try to say something important, they clap, 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 clap.
Cue the lines. Well, whether you can say it or not, keep trying to say it.
That's what's important.
You get that? Yeah.
Yeah. See, now, what do you think about when you hear that?
I forget. It takes me back, yeah. Well, that was very nice. We were, and there was work. I'm not trying to diminish. There was just a lot of serendipity in the Smothers Brothers. Young had a number one, had a big show, happened to be during these very culturally kind of shake... earthquake, cultural earthquake, and social. And we were young enough, and all those things happened. I always just say we were at the scene of the accident, made the best of it we could, sorting stuff out, and we were very dedicated to putting out as much as we could possibly say, as expressing as much as we could through the sketches and everything. I just, you know, you can't take credit for being at the, being born in America or being born somewhere else or wherever. So we were there. We did not shirk our duty to bring to television as intelligent and as interesting a show as we could. But I think circumstances really made a big difference, because if we'd have had that show in the 50s or we had it in the 80s, it would have never had the impact, even if we'd have been diligently trying to do the most intelligent, thoughtful observations about life.
Well, we're gonna move further up in the decades, but I got a couple more things I want to ask you about that time. One of which is perhaps your most famous act of defiance on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which is breaking the blacklist on Pete Seeger, mm-hmm, and booking him. And was that a calculated effort on your part to sort of rail against the CBS censors?
I believe that was in 68, one of the last two seasons. And I did get more stubborn, more resolute in my in my need, and our crew and our writers wanted to express things, and it was more calculated. As a matter of fact, I said to all our guests that were ever guests on it, whether it be new groups or old groups or actors or comedians, I always say, you're our guest on a show, was there anything you'd like to do? And we'd like to present what you'd like to do. And Pete Seeger said, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and we sang at rehearsal, and I said, that's right on, and be my guest. And then the censors looked at it and says, veiled reflection on our policy in Vietnam. It wasn't very veiled. But I did purposely say, yes, that's good. They cut it out. We brought him back the next year, and I said, what would you like to sing? He says, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. I said, well, be my guest this time, because it got so much publicity, and that the word ugly word censorship was coming up, that they let it go. And those it was the only show, I guess, that had a topical viewpoint about our involvement in Vietnam. It was a bad idea, and it was morally bankrupt, I thought, ethically wrong. But that consciousness came all over all of us in the process of doing the show.
Now, is it true? I don't know whether to believe you when I read this in print or not, but that you and Dick have actually attended brothers' therapy sessions?
When we were getting very near the end of our five-year, quote, our five-year plan, which is last year, he called me and he said he's been going to a lot of these group meetings, you know, like LifeSpring and other names for them. And he said, there are two people that I want to have a session with us. I think we work out some plans. It's the counselors. And I'm going, oh, no, not a, like a marriage counselor. He says, yeah, well, but not, they work with big corporations. They make personal and corporate breakthroughs, allowing people to function. Well, just talk about the Smothers Brothers. And I go, oh, man, I've never seen this work, you know. So I went with it, and these people came up. We had a very productive time. It cleared out a whole lot of things. And both Dick and I looked at each other and said, why didn't we do this 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or on a every two- or three-year basis, just to kind of clear the air, a third party who had no vested interest and could listen to us. Because we had legendary fights. Our fights were over timing and over material, and we are exact opposites, which is our little edge on stage, because we don't have to assume too much of a persona difference.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a 12-hour session, and people seemed to pick up on it. We said we went to see a counselor to help our relationship get stronger. One time Dick said, "How isn't it difficult working with your brother about 35, 40 years like this?" He says, well, it's like an old marriage. A lot of fighting, no sex. I thought, that's a funny line coming from the straight man.
Tom Smothers, recorded in 1997. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Smothers, the driving force behind the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which was yanked off CBS 30 years ago. I spoke with him in 1997. Okay, now that I've risked asking so many questions about the 60s, I want to go back even further just for a minute and just ask how you and your brother came to pick up the instruments that you did.
Well, my mother, our mother, Ruth Smothers, was always, when we were going back and forth to Grandma's house in the old Packard, we always sang songs. We always sang Down the Valley, Home on the Range, all these songs we'd be singing. And when I was about 7 years old, I just said, Mom, I wish I had a guitar. I want a guitar. And she got me a guitar, and I couldn't believe it. And I started learning to play it. Burl Ives was my first influence as far as musical about the guitar, and I wanted to be a band leader. Dick never played the instrument, was not interested. Then I saw, who was the guy? Little guy with the crew cut.
George Gobel?
George Gobel was my first comedic influence.
Hey, give me credit. That was a good one. go ahead.
That was good.
Okay, go ahead.
You did draw that right out there. As you get older, you know the proper names go. But George Gobel was...
It was either him or Eisenhower. I just went for it. Go for it.
And I saw him on Ed Sullivan's show talking about losing a bowling ball. And I remember I was about 16 years old. I said, oh, wow, that's funny. Didn't tell a single joke, but I was laughing. And I said, boy, I'd like to do that. I thought it was being a monologist, giving a monologue. I didn't even know what it was. So I started doing stuff in high school. And I was playing in a band, a little dance combo. And I'd also MC things. And I had this kind of funny delivery that had some funny spaces in it. And I was dreadfully serious, and I'd get laughs all the time. So the instruments came in, and when we got to be seniors in high school, we were singing in quartets and choirs, and Dick was the best tenor in the South Bay area of Redondo Beach, where we went to finish up high school. And so he was in our trio, our quartet. And the Kingston Trio and Harry Belafonte started singing calypsos and folk songs, and we started singing those kind of songs, and the comedy just took over. And I kind of got waylaid musically because the comedy became our central focus. And the most unique thing that we did, it was a unique relationship. And didn't have to be the best, but had to be unique. That's important. I always say the Wright Brothers plane wasn't that good, actually. But it was sure original, wasn't it?
Well, I don't mean to get into another brothers therapy session, but if sure. if Dick hadn't been the best tenor at Redondo Beach, would you have wanted your little brother in your band? Isn't there... Isn't that the age where it's kind of geeky to...
You're absolutely... Yeah, that's a great... I think when we were in high school, the only reason we started singing, because he was the best tenor. He was really good. He sang really in tune. And we always argued doing rehearsals. I always wanted to rehearse a lot. We'd get in our car and we'd drive up, and the three of us in the car, Dick would drive and I'd be playing the guitar in the front seat and rehearsing harmonies and things. But I think the musical side of it, I got to know my brother very well. Without that, we'd have been kind of strangers, like sometimes it happens.
I have to ask you one last question, because TV critics carry around these bizarre factoids, and if I don't ask at these sorts of times, I'll never get to use them.
Okay.
There has not been a top 10 variety show on television in more than 20 years. Last one was the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour in 73-74. Do you think people would still watch one when the idea that you can get your music off of MTV or VH1, or you can get your comedy off of Comedy Central, would today's audiences stay put for an Ed Sullivan style or Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour style variety show in the late 90s?
Well, I think definitely they would, but I mean, that's. I think that in this TV out there, we're switching. I think if we had something on Sunday nights, America on Stage, and it'd be a swift show, I think they would. But I think a variety show would go. But obviously no one else thinks that except you and me. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, for the whole family to sit down and watch some very good stuff and juggling and tumbling and some... cutting-edge comics and stuff, that'd be great.
Well, in the meantime, you guys want to, call me every Sunday night. I'll keep my line open. Well, listen, I want you to thank you. I want to thank you for being part of the show here and giving us the hour. And for all the television you gave me and my generation. I mean, I'm not real super geeky here, but I'm definitely a fan, and I feel like you helped form my personality a little bit and my musical tastes and my politics. So thanks.
Well, thank you.
Tom Smothers, recorded in 1997. Tom and Dick Smothers continue to perform in concert and on TV. Coming up, film critic John Powers reviews the new Clint Eastwood movie, True Crime. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Clint Eastwood directs and stars in the new death row thriller True Crime. Our film critic, John Powers, has a review.
Clint Eastwood made his name playing laconic loners who mistrusted authority, practiced rough justice, and never let anyone inside their heads. He was an icon of monolithic masculinity. But unlike most movie stars who cling to their personas, Eastwood has spent the last 25 years questioning the ideas of manhood he's famed for embodying. He's spoofed his image by co-starring with orangutans, let us gaze on his wrinkles and sagging flesh, and exposed how the Eastwood hero has unnerving similarities to the villains he's battling. He continues this process in True Crime, an enjoyable, implausibly plotted new thriller which has no bad guy, unless it's the hero played by Eastwood. He stars as Steve Everett, known as Ev, a fading reporter for the Oakland Tribune. A tireless philanderer, Ev cheats on his wife, played by Diane Venora, with the wife of the Metro editor. That's Dennis Leary. The selfish Ev doesn't even have time for his young daughter, played by Eastwood's own real-life daughter, Francesca. But Ev catches a glimpse of redemption when he's assigned to do a simple human interest sidebar on Frank Beecham, an African-American man sentenced to be executed for the murder of a white shop girl. But Ev's nose tells him there's something wrong with this conviction. Unfortunately, he has less than a day before Beecham will receive his lethal injection. Although True Crime builds to this deadline, the movie itself is loose and playful. Eastwood cares less about making this thriller thrilling than in revealing nuances of character. The way Ev slips his wedding ring back on after a night of adultery, or the way the prison guards roll their eyes at the self-promoting chaplain. Eastwood lets even the minor characters come to life. In fact, many of the most enjoyable moments are human interest sidebars rather than necessary to the dramatic plotline. The funniest bits are too obscene for radio, but you can get their flavor when Ev goes to tell his editor-in-chief, played by James Woods, that he thinks Beecham may be innocent.
What do you got on Frank Beecham? Oh, Ev. Ev.
Alan, yes.
Alan,
look, listen to me.
No, just... I don't have to listen to you. I'm looking at you. I'm looking, and I can see a reporter who's about to tell me he has a hunch.
I've been checking on some things.
Do you know my opinion of reporters who have hunches?
I've interviewed this witness who said he saw a gun. I don't think he saw a gun.
I can't fart loud enough to express my opinion.
Even Michelle thought the whole thing stunk. She thought there were discrepancies.
Discrepancies?
Yes.
After a police investigation, a trial, what, 6 years of appeals, and you found discrepancies? How long did it take you? What, all of half an hour?
Well, you know how the court system goes. His first attorney was probably some 12-year-old legal aid guy. He couldn't object enough for the appellate court to even make an intelligent decision. That's if they could make one.
Ev, come on. I got your appeal. Come on.
Alan, they're going to kill the guy tonight.
All right. I must be on acid. So you're trying to tell me that you want to turn a routine execution piece into some big fight for justice story. And what? That'll give me an excuse to stand up for you when Bob asked me to transfer you to the toilet. Is that it, huh?
This story matters because of what it reveals about the classic Eastwood persona, a persona quoted by presidents, make my day. But Eastwood knows that manhood isn't so simple as mouthing macho one-liners. Steve Everett may see himself as a heroic loner, but what that means in real life is that he treats his family shabbily, casually betrays his co-workers, and flits from story to story with no concern for the human beings involved. Just as Unforgiven brought a new depth to Eastwood's work, showing what a terrible thing it is to take a life, so True Crime finds the Eastwood figure exploring the cost of being an island unto yourself. Ev begins to grasp the consequences of his personal failings, and he gains a new respect for how precious and precarious life can be. There's no need to teach this lesson to the condemned man, who's movingly played by Isaiah Washington. True Crime spends a lot of time with Frank Beecham and his family, because their story is the mirror image of Ev's. Although once a young tough, Frank has grown into a decent man who tries to protect his wife and small daughter from the worst truths of his execution. In every way, he seems a better man than Ev. Warmer, more loving, more responsible. But he's also been convicted of murder. Without belaboring the point, True Crime suggests that the reasons for this are racial. Because he's white, Ev can mess up his life over and over and still be an accepted part of society. Because he's black, Frank's always on thin ice. His youthful mistakes make it easy for him to wind up on death row for a murder that nobody bothered to investigate properly. Because it's a Hollywood movie with a need for a satisfying finish, the last 20 minutes are filled with ticking clocks and racing cars. Untrue crime. But there's so much going on earlier in the film that I forgave this phony finale. This is Eastwood's most interesting and self-revealing movie since Unforgiven, one that shows how much his social awareness has changed. The conservative movie actor, whose character once coolly gunned down every crook in sight, has now directed a film that shows the horror and bigotry of capital punishment in America. John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, Book, the magazine for the reading life, covering books, authors, and the stories behind the stories on the shelf, available at bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mary Pfeiffer, the author of Reviving Ophelia, the groundbreaking work about the struggles of adolescent girls, has a new book about the elderly. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Mary Pfeiffer. And John Powers tells us what he thought about the Oscar Awards the morning after. Join us for the next Fresh Air.